all into his memory, knowing he would miss it. They spent their trip to the spaceport in near silence, until they moved out of the high-rise districts and into one of the traffic lanes, heading into the hangar portion of the spaceport.
"Think they'll turn us back?"
asked Ben. Luke gave him a curious look.
"Why would they?"
"Because we nearly wrecked the place a few days ago."
"You exaggerate. The fight didn't even spill over into the secure zones."
"True."
Soon enough, they sat down outside the hangar where Jade Shadow was berthed. Luke entered the lengthy access code in the security console beside the main doors, then peered into its optic sensor to give it a retinal reading. Finally, the great doors slid aside, admitting a wash of stale air, allowing Luke to look upon his dead wife's ship. It had started its career as a Horizon-class star yacht from premier shipmaker Sorosub, but had, over the years, been modified by Mara, family, and friends to become a combat vehicle that was fast and powerful for its size. Low and broad in the beam, with sleek curving lines, it had a top-mounted airfoil that swept down toward both sides and ended in external ion engine pods. Forward of those, outrigger-style plates stretched from the fuselage and curved down to hold external weapons emplacements. The ship's organic lines gave it the appearance of some nautical-shelled beast, and its non-reflective gray surface made its name an apt one. It did not suggest Mara's appearance so much as her manner when she was on the hunt. It was practical and implacable. It scarcely seemed the sort of ship to become home to a middle-aged widower and his teenage son. But it was what he had. Luke remotely activated its loading ramp and life support systems, letting it open and expel stale atmosphere while he and Ben removed their possessions from the airspeeder. Luke gave the speeder's droid brain an all-clear order, and it lifted off, accelerating away into the darkening sky, its shiny white coating making it visible for a considerable distance. It didn't take Luke and Ben long to complete a pre-flight check. The Jade Shadow's self-diagnostic circuitry and software were first rate, as were the Skywalker's technical skills. The engines had lost only a little stored power in the many months the yacht had sat unused. The various compartments within the yacht were a little dusty, but otherwise meticulously clean. Mara's personal craft, her Z-95 Headhunter, an old but reliable predecessor to the X-Wing, rested in its tiny launch bay. Though it was smaller and slower than its more famous descendant, Mara's Z-95, like her yacht, had been modified and optimized to within a centimeter of its life, and was a far more dangerous starfighter than others of its make and age. While the pre-flight check was underway, a delivery speeder arrived. Its crew offloaded two large crates full of supplies, fresh and preserved foods, water and bottled beverages, replacement battery packs, and glow rods. Ben signed for the goods and set about loading them into the Shadow's storage lockers. And then, it was all done. They had no more reason, no additional excuse to wait. It was time to leave Coruscant. Solemnly, Luke strapped into the pilot's seat, Ben into the co-pilot's. After a brief comm exchange with the spaceport's flight control center, Luke eased the yacht out of its berth. Many meters from the hangar, out over open permacrete, he raised it on repulsors, then aimed it toward the stars and punched the thrusters. The yacht's inertial compensators kept the acceleration from being a crushing experience, but Luke raced upward fast enough to press the two of them far back into their cushioned seats. Behind, in the rear-facing holocam view, the light glaring from Mara's hangar clicked off, and its doors slowly rolled shut. Moments later, they were up past the cloud layer and bound for the stars. Chapter 8. Things happened quickly after Luke's departure. Valen was released from Mon Mothma Memorial Medical Center and returned to Jedi custody. Silgal installed him in her own medical facility again, in a more secure chamber, and let him recover from sedation, though not anxious to face the escape attempts she had every reason to believe would come. She knew that endless sedation would have a damaging effect on Valen's health. The bounty hunters were mentioned in newscasts, not as bounty hunters, but as a special missions force answering to the office of the chief of state, officially part of her security detail. Their names were not mentioned. Jaina, who had inherited Ben's task of assembling data on them, noted those details and copied that broadcast for her own reference. The morning after Luke's departure, Master Hamner called a meeting of the Jedi Masters. He also invited several Jedi who were not Masters, but who were influential in the Order, including Leia and Jaina. They met in the Master's chamber, sitting among the circle of chairs once used by the old Jedi Council. Additional seating had been brought in for the assembly. There were, in the face of the Unification Summit and Luke's farewell, more Masters on Coruscant than could be routinely accommodated. Master Hamner began without preamble.
It seems clear that some of our recent trouble, the public reaction that gave the government so much of its leverage in its action against the Grand Master, arises because of the general public's state of ignorance concerning the Jedi Order.
There was some nodding among the Masters at this statement.
It is my intent to demystify the Jedi Order to the public as much as is reasonable, without impairing our effectiveness. I'd like for one Master to volunteer to be the subject of documentary coverage. That Master and his or her apprentice will be accompanied on an assignment or two by a documentary crew. The story they produce will be broadcast with, I hope, the result of making the Jedi more sympathetic in the public eye. Volunteers?
No hand raised. Saba Sebatine said,
This one is perhaps too ferocious for a documentary children will watch.
I think perhaps you're correct, Master Sebatine. No one? Ah, Master Remus, thank you.
Master Hamner consulted his datapad.
An independent producer has contacted us about his plan to create a holodrama about the Jedi. It sounds like mindless swashbuckling adventure, which ordinarily would stir me to some midpoint between apathy and contempt. But in our current situation, I think it will work in our favor. I have denied his rather naive request to consult our archives and record certain sequences in the temple.
There were sighs of relief among the Masters.
But I have promised to put forth the request that a Jedi Master serve as a technical consultant, and will give my permission to one who does. Here, too, do we have a volunteer? I will not insist. Ah, Master Durin, you just won me 50 credits. Thank you.
Sitting in one of the chamber's permanent chairs, Cam Solisar, obviously the loser of the bet, scowled. Now Master Hamner's manner became more grave.
Finally, we have some bad news to face. We have been informed by the Office of the Chief of State that, effective immediately, Jedi will be accompanied by government observers.
Several Masters, as well as both of the Solos, raised voices in protest. Leia said,
Are they trying to cripple our effectiveness?
Hamner waved them down.
One observer will be assigned to each Master-Apprentice pairing, and one to each Jedi operating solo. My apologies, Leia, Jaina. I mean each Jedi operating unpartnered. Their stated objective is to act as a gentle reminder to their Jedi of alliance and local laws. They will not have access to the secure areas of the temple, but will otherwise be able to accompany their Jedi most of the time, particularly outside the temple.
Kip Durin heaved a sigh.
There goes my social life.
Jaina's expression was a fixed frown.
Please tell me that we're not going to do this.
Hamner shrugged.
Actually, we are, for the time being. But I have retained the firm of the Grand Master's advocate, Noara Venn, to initiate a legal suit intended to strike down this government measure. Until we have some progress there, though, we simply have to endure this inconvenience. Observers will be assigned in stages over the next several days, Masters first, beginning tomorrow.
As the assembly left the chamber, Jaina was still wearing her frown.
I'm too young to begin harping about the good old days.
Leia ruffled her daughter's hair.
You're getting there. Just wait. You'll be talking about those blasted kids next. Mom! Solo Family Quarters, Coruscant.
I say, Master Han, Mistress Leia, I am so terribly sorry.
Han opened one eye. Though he was being awakened before his alarm had gone off, meaning it was too early by anyone's standards, he had not yet decided to shoot the tormentor awakening him, C-3PO, and therefore he did not need both eyes yet. Directly beside him was Leia, rousing just as reluctantly from sleep, her hair a tangled mess splayed across her face and pillow. Han's voice emerged as a hoarse rumble.
Where's my blaster?
Under your pillow as usual.
Leia's voice was almost as rough.
Sir, no!
C-3PO, standing by Leia's side of the bed, framed by the curtain viewport that, when barred, offered a vista of Coruscant aerial traffic and sky tower tops, waved awkwardly, as if to placate Han.
You have a call from Master Calrissian.
Han rubbed between his eyes.
Listen to the message in the morning.
Sir, it's a live holocom transmission from off-world.
That got Han's attention. He sat up. Leia did as well. Lando Calrissian was a rich man, and a generous one, but he did not waste credits on stunts like holocom calls just to show off his wealth. As far as Han knew, Lando was nowhere near Coruscant. This had to be important.
Tell him we'll be right there.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir, for not shooting me at this time of the morning, sir.
Moments later, wrapped in white robes but not yet fortified by calf, Han and Leia seated themselves at their quarters' comm console and took the main display off hold. The picture snapped from grayness to full-color clarity. Lando sat in a high-backed office seat, industrial gray walls and a closed door behind him. Dark-skinned and well-dressed, the image showed him wearing a maroon dress tunic and a black, sparkling hip cloak. Lando was, Han grudgingly admitted, aging nearly as well as Han himself. His hair had thinned and receded a bit, but remained dark, and his features, though more lined, were still handsome and elegant, and still ideally suited to wear expressions of suave self-confidence or comic dismay. Looking to one side as the picture went live, Lando snapped his attention back to the holoscreen and smiled.
Han, Leia, good to see you. Oh, is it morning there?
Leia, binding her hair back with an elastic band, glowered at him.
I'm not a gambler, but I'll bet 1,000 credits that you knew exactly what time it was before you called.
And I am a gambler, so I won't take that bet. You'd be right.
Lando gave her a look of apology.
I need help. Jedi help, I think, as well as friend help. That adds up to you and Han. And about the hour after the last event, we decided that there was no time to waste.
What sort of event?
Han turned to C-3PO, standing attentively off to the side, and mouthed the word calf. Then he turned back to Lando.
And who's we?
Nian Nunba and Tendra and me. Here, let me show you.
Lando reached forward, his hands disappearing to either side of the picture view, as he evidently grabbed his monitor. He turned it, swinging its holocam view off him. Han expected it to focus on Tendra, Lando's wife, or Nian Nunba, his Sullustan manager, but instead, it settled on a view of another gray wall, this one decorated with a holo of a shiny, skeletal YVH combat droid, which was manufactured by one of Lando's companies, Tendrando Arms. But it was not the three-dimensional picture of the menacing droid that drew Han's attention. It was the jagged crack in the wall behind it, stretching from upper right to lower left, passing beyond the holocom's field of view in either direction. Leia snorted. What caused that? A hut sat on your roof? Lando swung the monitor back to face him.
Quakes. Ground quakes. Nasty ones. They're increasing in strength and frequency. And the scientists I've brought in can't figure out why.
Han frowned. Nian Nunba was the manager of Lando's Glitterstim spice mines, which strongly suggested where Lando must be now.
You're on Kessel?
Lando nodded.
I'm in the auxiliary comm center of my main office building. The primary comm center was destroyed in the last quake.
Han grimaced.
Lando, let it go. Kessel is a doomed world.
Kessel, an undersized planet near the Maw, was notorious for many things.
smoked was the origin of Glitterstim, a drug with just as many illegal applications as legal ones, and the source of a great deal of smuggling activity. Its spice mines were infamous, having been operated by convict labor for so long that decades after the system had changed, going to the spice mines of Kessel was still a fate promised to children to convince them to behave. The planet was also one of the marker points on the smuggler and race route that bore its name, the Kessel Run. Over time, the low-gravity planet was bleeding atmosphere into space. Ancient atmosphere generation plants increasingly struggled to keep up with the loss, but they were gradually failing. The world would eventually become a lifeless environment. Lando shook his head.
It's still a profitable operation, and the only source of Glitterstim anywhere. Efforts to transplant colonies of the energy spiders that produce the stuff haven't been very successful.
Han sat upright.
You're trying to get them to survive on other planets?
Yes, but they just stop feeding and die.
Good.
Lando waved his outburst away.
We need more time to work on the problem. Lots more time.
Han repressed a shudder. Once, back in his smuggler days, before he'd ever met Luke or Leia, he had dumped a load of Glitterstim rather than be caught with it by Imperial investigators, a decision that had resulted in him being hunted for years by hirelings of the spice's owner, Jabba the Hutt. Much later, he had spent time in those mines, among the convicts, and had been one of the first to survive an attack by an energy spider and reveal the species' existence to the galaxy. The experience had left him with bad memories.
You do need a Jedi.
He gave Lando a helpful nod.
You need Kip Duren. He's a master. He spent a lot more time in those mines than I did.
Lando mimicked his tone.
He's impossible to deal with. He hates Kessel more than you do, and he's not my friend.
Of course we'll help, Leia said.
Han looked at her.
No. Wait until you've had some calf. Your reasoning centers will kick in.
Hush.
She returned her attention to Lando.
We'll launch today.
Lando sighed, relieved. In his impossibly smooth and gracious manner, he said,
Bless you, Leia. You too, Han.
Han managed to keep his teeth from clenching.
Think nothing of it. We'll let you know when we're en route, old buddy.
He switched off the holocomp connection. Then he turned to glare at his wife. She gave him a look that was all innocence.
What?
Don't you have to clear things like this through the temple before you rush off?
Theoretically, yes. But not this time. It's better to help a friend and take your punishment than be refused permission and not be able to help.
All right, how about this? Kessel?
Innocent beings live on Kessel. Even the energy spiders don't deserve to die just because they spooked you.
Nothing spooks me.
Then you won't mind going back.
I do mind. Did you forget about Alana?
From the way Leia froze, it was clear she had forgotten Alana. Perhaps only because Leia was sleep-fogged. Alana, known to everyone but Han and Leia as Amelia, and never referred to by her real name except in the utmost privacy, was the daughter of Jason Solo and Tenel Ka, conceived before Jason's recent efforts to gain mastery over the galaxy. She was Han and Leia's granddaughter, raised for her first 5 years by Tenel Ka, Queen Mother of the Hapes Consortium. At the end of the war between the Alliance and the Confederation, Tenel Ka falsely announced Alana's death to protect her from those who might kill her to gain the Hapen throne. Tenel Ka had sorrowfully given the care of her daughter to Han and Leia. The girl, now 7, lived these days under the guise of Amelia, adopted daughter of the Solos. If Han and Leia raced off to Kessel, they'd have to take her along, or leave her behind with near strangers. Alana's Aunt Jaina was no stranger, but her life as a Jedi was an active and dangerous one. Luke and Ben were gone. There was no one else left whom they could entrust with Alana.
We take her with us.
Leia's voice was decisive.
Don't get mad at me to cover up the fact that you forgot.
Han pointed an accusing finger at her.
We agreed to settle down as much as possible for her sake. We agreed that we couldn't drag a little girl around the galaxy as we stupidly try to fix other stupid people's stupid problems.
That's just it.
There was a note of desperation in Leia's voice.
We weren't able to do anything for Luke.
We can't do anything to stop the bureaucratic catastrophe that's descending on the Jedi Order right now. But we might be able to help a friend.
Han considered. When she put it like that, he'd never regretted marrying a woman who could out-argue him on just about every issue, but he was often inconvenienced by it.
Of course, if we just take off this morning without telling anyone where, you won't get assigned your own government spy.
Observer. And you're right. We wouldn't be accompanied by a nosy intruder who inconveniences you as much as me.
And Alana wouldn't have to put up with a stranger.
Also correct.
We already lose a lot of private time raising a little girl. Add a government spy and we lose the rest.
Leia nodded, encouraging him to continue down that line of reasoning.
And it could be put off even longer if the Falcon's hyperdrive were to fail somewhere out there.
It's happened before.
Sabotage. Always sabotage.
He grinned at her.
You're going to be in trouble with Kenth Hamner when you get back.
That's what I keep you around for, to drag me into trouble.
Whatever you say.
Han leaned forward for a kiss.
Master Han, your calf. Master Han? Mistress Leia? Oh, dear.
Residential district near the Jedi Temple, Coruscant.
How did you manage to get free of your head of state duties and bodyguards? Jaina asked.
Jag leaned against the doorframe where they'd just arrived. This was one hallway of a residential high-rise. The passageway, its walls decorated with brown rhombuses against a tan background, spoke of a decorative style several years old, but was meticulously clean. Even now, a mouse droid affixed atop a circular cleaning attachment was gliding down the hallway, buffing dirt up out of the carpet and sending a faint, sweet smell of cleanser into the air.
Most of what my delegation does is negotiate insanely minute points.
Jag looked as though he found that prospect about as attractive as a bowl full of worms.
I let my advisors and advocates do that, and at the end of the day, I veto every decision they've made. Thus is the balance of power between ruler and bureaucrat maintained. In the meantime, I get to spend my day with you, and I tell my bodyguard that you're protecting me. That's where your ferocious Jedi reputation helps me.
Jaina shook her head.
The system is unimaginably broken.
She pressed the button beside the door. Beyond the door, a chime faintly sounded.
But fun,
Jag said. The door slid open, but no one stood there. There was only a short green hallway beyond, a door open and brightly illuminated at the far end. Jaina caught the scent of freshly cut grass, if her nose did not deceive her. She gave Jag a quizzical look and preceded him in. The door slid shut behind them. The hallway opened into a large chamber that had probably been intended as a living or family room, but where overhead glow rods would normally shine comfortably and placidly, there were brighter light fixtures, emitting, Jaina suspected, the exact frequencies of sunlight. Where comfortable padded furniture should sit, instead rested weatherproof outdoor furnishings of light foamed durasteel supports and colorful strapping. There were chairs, lounges, even a patio table with a large umbrella overhead. One picture viewport, as tall as an adult human and twice as long, admitted light and a view of buildings 50 meters away, stretching upward and downward as far as the eye could see from Jaina's position. Streams of airspeeder traffic at just the altitude of this apartment added a dash of fast-moving color. Tahiri Vela, former Jedi, former Sith apprentice, stood up from a piece of lounging furniture as they entered. Blonde and attractive, she wore a simple, tight-fitting jumpsuit in gray. She was, as usual, barefoot. Her lightsaber was not at hand, but lay nearby, on the patio table. Her expression was just a touch uncertain. The scars on her forehead, earned during the Yuuzhan Vong War, were not visible. Jaina doubted that they could have faded in just a few months since she had last seen Tahiri, so they were probably concealed by makeup. Tahiri nodded to them.
Jedi Solo, Colonel, I mean, head of state fell.
Jag spoke, his manner brusque.
Tahiri.
Please, sit down. Can I get you anything? Calf, water?
No, thank you.
Jaina took one of the lightweight chairs and sat facing Tahiri. Jag did likewise. Tahiri settled again on her lounger. Jaina gestured at the grass.
Please tell me that your refresher doesn't have a dirt floor.
That broke through Tahiri's discomfort, and she grinned.
No, perfectly normal tile.
She looked over her living green carpet.
I've always preferred being barefoot to wearing shoes, but most places just aren't that comfortable. Overheated permacrete, carpets where they glare at you for tracking in dirt. Now that I have some credits to spend, I decided I wanted a home where I could be comfortable. And this is much nicer than Tatooine desert sand.
Now that you have credits and aren't living by anyone else's rules, Jaina amended.
That's right.
Jag leaned forward.
We're here to ask you a few questions about Jason Solo.
Tahiri's uncertain look returned.
You really don't need to say Jason Solo. When his sister comes to talk to his former apprentice and Jason is mentioned, I'm not going to suppose you mean some Jason who waits tables.
Of course.
Jag gave Jaina a pained look.
In informal circumstances, I really am redundant and stuffy, aren't I?
Jaina nodded.
Yes, but you're pretty.
She returned her attention to Tahiri. You've heard about the Grand Master and his sentence. Tahiri nodded.
I heard about his farewell. I thought about going, but I was pretty sure I wouldn't be welcome. Not by everyone.
We're trying to get a better handle on Jason's thought processes. What made him turn? When he turned? It's all part of an effort to help the Grand Master, to help Uncle Luke, make his case for his return to Coruscant.
People have been trying to understand Jason for 2 years.
Tahiri shrugged as if the task were hopeless.
No, people have been trying to understand him since we were apprentices, since you two and Anakin were children together. They've been coming to me since he died, Jedi and government investigators and doctors and the press.
Jaina gave her a sympathetic look. Any friends among them? Tahiri hesitated, then shook her head.
I'm not sure I have any friends. Not that I blame anyone for that. Anyone but Jason. And myself.
Jaina resisted the urge to join in with Tahiri's critics and give the younger woman a verbal beating. It wouldn't help in this situation.
You're not likely to make any either as a bounty hunter. You need to come back to the Order, Tahiri. Not until I know who I am. What I am.
Tahiri smoothed an errant strand of blonde hair back from her cheek.
I've been more things than I can count. Tatooine girl, adopted Tusken Raider, Jedi, Yuuzhan Vong hybrid, Sith apprentice, addict. I've got to get rid of all of them for a while. Learn how to hear myself think.
Jag nodded.
So think about Jason. What have you figured out about him that you haven't told anyone? Details too subtle or seemingly inconsequential. Information that nobody ever asked about.
I can't tell you when he became a Sith.
Tahiri's expression became unfocused.
Only that it might not be important when he did. Or even that he did. I think Sith was just another thing. Another set of armor and weapons and disguises that he put on top of Jason. Like Jedi or Solo. He was always Jason. Until he rejected that too. And became Kydus.
Jaina shook her head, not comprehending.
You're saying that it didn't matter when he became a Sith? Something like that.
Tahiri snapped back to the here and now.
I think it matters more when Jason broke. Maybe he broke when Vergeer tortured him for all that time. Maybe he broke when he was a kid, when he and you and Anakin kept being handed off to nannies and protectors while your mother and father were off doing other things.
Tahiri raised a hand to forestall a biting response from Jaina.
I'm not criticizing. They were being pulled in too many directions at once, by too many responsibilities. And when that happens, something gives.
She frowned, trying to puzzle something out.
I think maybe he broke at some other time. Whenever it was, he decided that the galaxy was a huge, nasty place that had to be tamed. Whatever gave him that idea, it made such an awful impression that he had to become even more awful to confront it.
Jag looked dubious.
You don't think Lumaya broke him?
I think she shaped him.
Now Tahiri looked vulnerable, far more open than when Jaina and Jag had first entered her presence.
I've been broken. I was broken by the Yuuzhan Vong.
I broke when Anakin died, and again when I learned that I could be with him again in little moments. Every time you break, outside forces can shape you, and you can't do anything to stop them. No, I don't think it matters when Jason became a Sith. I think it matters when he broke.
Jaina and Jag exchanged a glance. Jaina said, "That's an interesting theory." Tahiri managed a bitter little laugh.
"Solo speak, for that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. No, I'm serious. I'll pass it on to the Grand Master. Right or wrong, it suggests some avenues of investigation that we haven't considered."
"Oh." Mollified, Tahiri relaxed.
"Thank you."
As they were departing, Jaina, seized by a sudden impulse, embraced Tahiri, something she had not done in years, and Tahiri held her in turn. On the walk to the turbo lift, Jag said,
"I'm afraid I can't find a way to forgive her so readily. She assassinated a man I respected very highly."
Jaina nodded.
"I had a lot of respect for Admiral Pellion, too. But who really killed him? The woman we just talked to, who's trying to find her way back from a very dark place? Or the woman of 2 years ago?"
"One descends from the other. They're inextricably linked."
Stopping before the turbolift, Jag pressed the button to summon the car.
"Does someone shed all responsibility for what she's done when she suddenly decides it was wrong?"
"Neither one of us has ever been broken the way she has."
Jaina found her voice was unusually gentle. "Maybe we're too hard-headed or too stupid, or we've just never run into anything that could damage our core selves the way it happened to her. How do you know what we'd be capable of doing in her situation?" Jag thought about it and merely shrugged.
"The Jedi have more faith in redemption than I do. I'm not saying my way is best, just that I'm not sure I could do what you do. Forgive something that monstrous."
"I hope I never make a really big mistake in your presence, then."
Chapter 9 Jedi Temple, Coruscant.
As a senior Jedi Knight, one who, it was said, was under consideration for the rank of master, Jaina warranted private quarters when staying in the temple. They were small and bare, but offered her more peace than the dormitories reserved for younger Jedi Knights and apprentices. At her desk, she studied preliminary information assembled on her behalf about the Chief of State's bounty hunters. The Quarren was almost certainly Didal Nizz, an inventor specializing in imprisonment and capture technologies. He had made some of his fortune capturing high-value fugitives, some from patents and military contracts. The dark-haired woman had given her name as Zalash Kuhl to both Luke and the press. There was no mention of her in Jedi files, and she had no criminal record. Hollows that showed her lightsaber had been magnified and strenuously analyzed, only to reveal that its hilt seemed to have been modeled on that of Obi-Wan Kenobi's last lightsaber, the one the legendary